at KJAZ. 89.5 FM, KJZA Radio, Drake, Prescott, Williams, Cottonwood, Flagstaff, Arizona. Your national public radio and community programs connection. Coming up next, it's Dr. John Nay and the program Dinosaurs, Science, and the Bible. And be sure to listen at 9:30 this morning for Gerald Rogers and the program The Mountain Gardener from Waters Garden Center in Prescott.
And welcome to the 36th edition of Dinosaur Science and the Bible with Dr. John Nay, retired religion professor from Summit College in Nebraska. Dr. John, last week we started talking about how evolution, the worldview of evolution, stacks up against the scientific method, and we saw that it failed miserably. And are we going to continue on with that thought here this week?
Yes, and it will continue to fail miserably, if you might. And yes, we took the proposal to task, if you will, that the creation viewpoint is inherently religious, and the evolution viewpoint, of course, is science. Well, if we talk science, then how can we talk science without speaking or referring to the scientific method? And as we saw last week, the scientific method is defined in Webster's Ninth New Collegiate Dictionary as principles and procedures for the systematic pursuit of knowledge involving the recognition and formulation of a problem. Why or how did this happen? The collection of data through observation and experimentation and the formulation and testing of hypotheses. And we talked about the scientific method of investigation and what it was designed to be about. And that is, you make an observation of a phenomenon. You see something happen and you don't know why or how it happened. And you form a guess as to why or how it might have happened. Now, all we're going to do is take the word guess and put a big word in its place. If we're going to take this guess into the laboratory and subject this guess to controlled experimentation, the guess we're going to now call a scientific hypothesis. Webster's defines hypothesis as a tentative assumption, something you're going to hold for a time, made to draw out and test its logical and empirical, what you can see, consequences. In other words, you form a guess as to why or how this happened. You're going to take that guess, that hypothesis, into the lab, into the laboratory, and you're going to subject this assumption, this thing that's assumed to be true, to controlled experimentation to see as to whether or not it's a good guess. And, of course, if you you go through and you, through controlled experimentation, you test this guess and it does not hold up, it doesn't appear to be a good guess, we throw it out and we need to form another guess. We're back to square one. Now, if through controlled experimentation, what you have guessed as to why or how this happens appears to have some credibility or validity to it, well, through controlled experimentation, then this guess, this hypothesis, will evolve or will change to scientific theory. And as mentioned last week, a theory under the scientific method is a technical term that has a very specific definition. And theory under the scientific method is a scientific hypothesis that has been demonstrated to have validity to it. It's a good guess. So it eventually becomes scientific theory. Now, again, a technical term, not as the other way the term is used. I have an idea of this or a theory about that or a theory of whatever. And the scientific method, hypothesis, been demonstrated to have validity to it. Now, through continuing with controlled experimentation, if this scientific theory appears to be without exception, then eventually it becomes, or if you will, evolves into scientific law. Well, the key, of course, as what we shared last week, is the fact that the scientific hypothesis is based upon an observation. And that was the key thing. You know, and here we're talking about the origin of life. When we take and we make application of the scientific method to the origin of life and the observation of that phenomenon as to why or how this single-celled animal or whatever began, okay, we have to have the observation. Well, who is here to observe that, you see? Now, it's one thing to apply control experimentation to the world around us, which is what the scientific method is really supposed to be about, and then perhaps to postulate, extrapolate, or propose, based upon this experimentation, we propose this is how life may have begun. Now, that would be honest, and it would be qualified, but to say that this is how life began, and to make that as a scientific fact, a factual statement, it is outside the realm of the scientific method.
In other words, it's a lie.
Yeah, okay, I agree with that.
That's why
you need to cut to the heart of things and quit holding back, Dave.
I hate that we lie to our kids. Yeah.
You're just always tippy-toeing around things, you know. And when you get it right out where you can see it, absolutely, it's intellectually dishonest. And when you take any form of education and you don't attempt to supply all of the information to the students, whomever they might be, then it becomes a form of brainwashing. And since you jumped right into the heart of this, the pith of the matter, so to speak, that is what we see happening now in our country, unfortunately, in public education and in our secular entertainment rings also, Discovery Channel, National Geographic. We see only one view relative to the beginning of life presented. It permeates our culture. If we're going to speak about science, which that's where we're going here this morning, that view of how life began is outside of the realm of the scientific method. It's a philosophical view. We talk about, well, this is how I think it happened, or that happened, whatever. Those are philosophies. And philosophy, by the way, if you look up the word philosophy and you look up the definition of the word philosophy, it is quite the opposite of the scientific method. It is based upon speculation other than through observation. And I'll get to that definition back here before we're through here this morning. Matter of fact, here it is in front of me now. Webster's Ninth New Collegian Dictionary defines philosophy as, quote, a search for a general understanding of values and reality by chiefly speculative rather than observational means. So when we talk about the origin of life, you know, the view that the creation is inherently religious because the creation account necessitates a creator, and that is a philosophy, yes it is. And if one embraces that philosophy as absolute truth, that we are a product of the creator God, and we are the creation, a part of the creation, and we believe that the Bible is the lamp unto our feet, the light unto our path, and we use that as the foundation for determining what is or is not true. If we use that to form our personal worldview, our personal paradigm, and attempt to pattern our lives in accordance with that philosophy of life, then by definition that has become our religion. So I have no problem with that part. Okay, the part that I have difficulty with is proposing that evolution is science, and not only is it science, but it's scientific fact, when it doesn't even qualify under the scientific method of investigation. And then when we look at the results of scientific investigation into the world around us, and then we make statements of something that happened supposedly 4.5 to 4.8 billion years ago when Earth was formed as absolute fact, we're not talking about science, we're talking about philosophical view. And
and John, when you look at the law, not the theory, not the hypothesis, the law of biogenesis, that states that life only comes from life and cannot come from non-life, then it's no-brainer. And evolution is not even a good hypothesis. Forget about theory. It's not even a decent hypothesis.
Yes, you can't form the hypothesis because, again, we don't have the observation. The scientific method begins with observation. And then the controlled experimentation is based upon observation. And as you've mentioned, when it comes to the origin of life, the two options, either it began by itself, so we'll call that spontaneous generation, or someone started it.
John, why is this whole theory of evolution, why is it always long ago and far away? Why can't they see it, if it really happened then, long ago and far away, why can't they see it happening today?
Well, that's a profound question, okay? Why is it always long ago? To begin with, of course, you can take something that is that we would classify as ludicrous. You know, that let's say this young girl's taking a biology, and she wants to take one of the worms home. And the professor says, well, why do you want to take the worm home? She says, well, I'm looking for a boyfriend, and I think that this worm could evolve into that boyfriend. Okay, absolutely, totally nuts, of course. Okay, but somehow, if you inject the magic wand of mutations and millions and millions and millions of years, somehow this ludicrous thing becomes somewhat a little more palatable. Well, who's to say it couldn't happen in millions and billions and billions of years? Well, I would most certainly say that.
But John, it's the magic ingredient.
That is it. That is the magic wand. Somehow, you know, again, you say you kiss a frog, turn him to a handsome young prince. We call it a fairy tale. But if you put in that millions and millions of years between that amphibian, the frog, and the handsome young prince, somehow, something that is, again, completely crazy, takes on some form of credibility, or it titillates the imagination, whereby you say, well, maybe that, yeah, I could see, and you begin to see wonderful things in the test tube I see, things put there by you and by me, just absolutely insane.
A fairy tale for adults.
You're quoting some. I'm trying to remember who you're quoting. You're quoting someone right now, and the man's an evolutionist that made that statement, by the way. When it comes to the origin of life, this isn't just myself saying this here this morning, that there are only two options, either life began by itself or someone started it. But Dr. George Wald, this man is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in Science, 1967. So this man is... I think would most consider to be a credible scientist, and he made this statement relative to the beginning of life. He said, quote, when it comes to the origin of life on this earth, and if I might add, or anywhere, there are only two possibilities. Creation, someone started it, or spontaneous generation, it started by itself, evolution. There is no third way. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago. But that leads us only to one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. Now, we're doing pretty good so far. It makes sense to me. Now, the quote continues, though. Listen to this. We cannot, first person plural now all of a sudden, we cannot accept that is supernatural creation, on philosophical grounds. He didn't say on scientific grounds. He said on philosophical grounds, that is, personal reasons. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. Dr. George Wald, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in Science, 1967.
Finally, an honest evolutionist.
Yeah, I mean, at least he's honest about it. You know, he says, we choose to believe the impossible. That is, it's a choice. And it is a belief. We choose to believe the impossible, absolutely diametrically opposed to what we found in controlled experimentation. You know, it's like I'm going to, well, I guess we come back to the foundation that people believe what they choose to believe.
Yes.
Which sounds overly simplistic, but it absolutely is true. Yeah, I recall years ago, Dave, speaking at a convention, Wyoming State Convention, and I had someone there that was in a scientific discipline, very well known throughout Wyoming, that region, as far as tells and digging up dinosaur bones and things like that, paleontologist, and he had also a professing Christian, Bible believer, but he had nothing from Scripture to support his view of the age of Earth being 4.5, 4.6 billion years, and the cosmos 18, 20 billion years, could come up with nothing scriptural, okay, but would not accept what, at least what I believe to be, good exegesis or drawing out or hermeneutics, principles of interpretation of what the Bible says relative to the age. They just simply wouldn't accept it. You know, and I remember coming home from that convention, and I'm walking the hallway down to, and at the college downstairs where my classroom was, and a very good friend of mine, Dr. Gerald Perriott, in case he listens to the program, walking by, and I'm upset, and he said, John, what is the matter? And I told him about the convention thing, and he said, well, John, you need to understand, people believe what they choose to believe.
Right.
You know, and I would pray as I'm saying this, that I'm still pliable personally. You know, that I'm pliable enough there that at least if I come across information or information shared with me that it, from my perspective appears to make sense and makes better sense relative to what I believe to be true, that I would be willing to change. That's how we grow. As iron sharpens iron, so one man another. And never to come to the point where, you know, I've made up my mind that's absolutely, I'm completely blocked off as far as any additional information, like a block of cement, all mixed up and permanently set.
Yeah, John, you know, I find that when I'm talking to evolutionists about their idea of evolution, their fairy tale idea, the hardest thing for me to get is for them to listen to any kind of evidence. I've got many, many cassette tapes, DVDs, videos and books about this topic, and when I suggest that I give them one or loan them one, and they could just think about some of the evidences against the theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. No, hardly any of them will even take a minute to look at the evidences, and so I find that that's a real barrier. You know, it's like the attitude is, don't confuse me with the facts. I've already got my mind made up.
And how do you grow that way? And I would hope we all consider, what I just mentioned relative to myself, that I pray I am still pliable and open for information and for changing views, shifting views, saying, hey, I'm wrong. But it sounds a little cynical on my part, but I think generally speaking, most people are not. That sounds really a little like I've just puffed myself up a little bit, but I think generally speaking, many people are not. They're not willing to take the time to really dig in and is this true? Is this not true? You know, am I correct or do I need to tweak my view or completely throw out my view and accept this other view, which definitely appears to be the right one? I found that humbling as a professor at a Bible college over the years. Many times in a class, I have a student bring something up that maybe is a course I've been teaching for 15 years. And still to really consider what was said. And over the years, I found myself listening closer and closer to my students because I learned so much from them. And oftentimes, it wasn't the student that was a straight-A student either. It might have been some kid that was just goofing off. But that didn't discredit what he had to say if, in fact, it were true. So, it's disturbing to me that, and what's put throughout the evolution camp is, you know, don't even take time to deal with these creation wackos, okay? It's not worth your time. You know, I think of a cult, where somewhere a person's told in a cult, don't you listen to your parents now. You just cut this off completely. Not even worth your time. They're coming from a completely different world. You know, now you have control. You know, you have mind control. And we're back to that passage, Proverbs 18:17. You know, any story sounds true until someone tells the other side. If you never hear the argumentation from the other side in a credible way. Now, the creation side is it's in the secular educational system here and there. It's on the television here and there, but never it would appear in a credible way. You know, it misrepresents the creation viewpoint. You know, which I find even more alarming than not having the creation viewpoint represented at all. Because when it is mentioned, it's mentioned awfully often in a discrediting way. And where the person says, yeah, they're right, it's not even worth my time talking about this because you're off in la-la land. You believe the earth is flat still, you know, kind of thing. Or geocentricity, the earth is the center of the universe. How are we doing on time?
10 minutes.
So, okay, 10 minutes, a little bit. Something I want to mention here real that I didn't get into last week, this thing about the origin of life again. You know, two options, as Dr. Wald mentioned, either it began by itself or someone started it. It's been demonstrated that it could not have begun by itself. That demonstration was through controlled experimentation. That's under the scientific method that it couldn't happen by itself, okay? So again, that only leaves supernatural creation. But man doesn't give up. He keeps on trying. Now, some of you that are listening this morning in a biology course somewhere, perhaps, have been told about the Miller-Urey experiment. Some have accepted the Miller-Urey experiment as having proven that life can come about through time and chance. Now, to refresh your memory a little bit, if this means something to you, in this experiment, water vapor, ammonia, methane, and hydrogen were subjected to spark discharges and simple amino acids were synthesized. Although this experiment demonstrates conclusively that organic compounds can be artificially made. Now, let me interject this real quick. This is controlled. This is in a laboratory, a controlled environment. Everything was, and this was being done by, supposedly, some very fine minds, some very intelligent people that had all these resources to themselves, again, in a controlled environment. That's very important, what I just said. Can be artificially made. Such products do not even remotely approach the synthesis of life. To take amino acids and synthesize them, and then to compare that with the synthesis of life, a protozoan or a single-cell life form, two completely different worlds. It would be like taking and making a paper airplane, folding a paper airplane, and that's the amino acids, if you will, and comparing that to the space shuttle in complexity. Completely two different worlds. Now, also, achieving this sort of accomplishment in the laboratory under carefully designated and controlled conditions, as I've mentioned, and having the exact same thing or something more complex occur in an open system apart from any directing intelligence are two entirely different things. You know, I think of a cartoon I saw some years back in some magazine I was reading, and it shows us that a scientist it would appear to be in some kind of a frenzy, and he's working with his vials and whatever there, and he makes this statement. The caption goes like this: "If I can just synthesize life here, I will have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form it in the beginning." You know, I know. So we have the finest minds working to do this, and if man ever did in a test tube, if you will, create, or I use the term form a protozoan, a single cell life form. Does that prove then that it happened initially without any intelligent intercession? Absolutely not. Matter of fact, it's quite the opposite. It would support our case that it calls for a creator. Now, when it comes, some of the objections to this experiment, by the way, just a couple of them real quick, five of them. One of them is the concentrations of methane and ammonia were carefully selected to ensure the production of organic molecules. These were selected. There is no evidence to suggest that the Earth's primitive atmosphere was so characterized. Number two, there is no evidence to indicate that Earth's early atmosphere was reducing. There is, however, considerable evidence to suggest that the Earth had an oxidizing atmosphere over most, if not all, of its history. Number three, a methane-ammonia-reducing atmosphere would be fatal to life forms. It would kill them. Number four, the simulation of lightning by mild spark discharges is unrealistic. I have never seen mild spark discharges. We're talking about lightning. Actual lightning would have destroyed any organics which may have been present. Number five, the molecules produced by this experiment would react detrimentally to life forms which were trying to evolve. Chemically, they would destroy all hope of producing life. And again, if man ever does create or form life in a test tube, it most certainly would not demonstrate that no intelligence was necessary to form it in the beginning in an open system. It would actually support our case that it did take intelligence for this to come about. How are we doing on time, Dave? We're just getting down to, 6 minutes. Okay, good. You're good with that. You do that either way. You had five on this hand, one on this, and you did it the other way. It's kind of like the fellow said, you know, well, on the other hand, yeah, I have other fingers, okay? So I may have a couple minutes here before we get ready to close out. You know, contrary to what is propagated by our secular society, there are many credible scientists that still believe in the creation account of the Bible. Going back, walking through history, I'm just going to read a few of these, a couple minutes worth here. Things that I think to some extent have been basically censored out of our secular educational system, especially in the science classes. Johann Kepler, he's the founder of physical astronomy. He made this statement, quote, "Since we astronomers are priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature, It befits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all else, of the glory of God. Johann Kepler was a believer, and he was the founding father of physical astronomy. Sir Francis Bacon, we've been talking about the scientific method. He's the founder of the scientific method. He made this statement. There are two books laid before us to study to prevent our falling into error. First, the volume of the Scriptures, capitalized, uppercase S, which reveal the will of God. Then the volume of the creatures, which express His power. Sir Isaac Newton, laws of motion, law of gravity. Sir Isaac Newton made this statement. He wrote many, by the way, real quick, he wrote many books on biblical subjects. He wrote a book defining the chronology of Bishop Usher. Some of you may have an older King James Bible, and you go to Genesis, and up in the upper left-hand, above verse 1, you might see 4004 B.C. That had to do with Bishop Usher's chronology, work from Scripture, going back to the creation of 4004. Well, Sir Isaac Newton wrote a book defending his view, or in other words, that the earth was created somewhere in the neighborhood of 4004 B.C. He also wrote refuting atheism and defending the creation and the Bible. He believed in a worldwide flood and that it accounted for most of the geological phenomena, and he believed in the literal six-day creation account. This is Sir Isaac Newton, not some pseudoscientist, okay? And he made this statement relative to the Scriptures. He said, quote, "We account the Scriptures of God to be the most sublime philosophy, and it is a philosophy. If you embrace it and use it for your discernments, it becomes your religion. I find more sure marks of authenticity in the Bible than in any profane history whatsoever." William Herschel, astronomer, made this statement. He discovered double stars in Uranus and constructed the greatest reflecting telescopes of his day, and he said this, "The undevout astronomer must be mad." Michael Faraday, great physicist that he was, instrumental in developing the new sciences of electricity and magnetism, discovered electromagnetic induction and introduced the concept of magnetic lines of force. He invented the generator. He made this statement, and I'm going to close out now. He made this statement, "The Bible and it alone and nothing added to it or taken away from it by man is the sole and sufficient guide for each individual at all times and in all circumstances. Faith in the divinity and the work of Christ is the gift of God, and the evidence of this faith is obedience to the commandment of Christ." Michael Faraday, physicist. This whole idea that no credible scientist would believe in the creation account, a creator, a young earth, a global flood, is without foundation when one takes the time to look into this.
That's right, John. It is not just the scientist of yesteryear. It's also the scientist of today. Many, many scientists are creationists today. The locally here, we have the Science Research Center in Chino Valley, who have 600 scientists signed up under their statement of belief that in a literal six-day creation. Mm-hmm. And these are all, you know, working scientists with master's and doctorate degrees.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's just one of many, many creation organizations out there. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more than that.
But it's not the politically correct view, so many of you listening this morning have never heard what Dave just shared.
That's right. In fact, there's a lot of, if you saw that movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, you'll understand that the tremendous amount of peer pressure and tremendous amount of persecution that you will go under if you stand up and say, "I'm a creationist," in the scientific field. Mm-hmm. John, it's time to sign off here pretty soon. How can people send you their questions?
You can address questions to my email site, and that is jnay@creationscience.net. Jnay, that's with an N. jnay@creationscience.net. I solicit your questions, your input. I'd really like to hear from you, whether you agree or disagree. As iron sharpens iron, so one man another. And I, again, ask you to contact me with your comments. I'd appreciate it.
And what about your website, John? Is that going to be up soon?
That's still under construction, and it's when it's done, it's being done very well. But right now, you can look at the homepage at dev www.creationscience.net. But you can just see what the homepage looks like. But a lot to be done yet, so that's why I solicit your email directly to me.
Very good. Come on back next week for more of Dr. John Nay.
Listen for two new programs every Sunday morning right here on publicly supported KJAZZ. At 10 a.m., Sherry...